I have received recognition or praise for doing good work. Q5. My supervisor or someone at work seems to care about me as a person. Q6. There is someone at work who encourages my development. As a manager, if you want to know what you should do to build a strong and productive workplace, securing fives to these six items is an excellent place to start. We will return to these items in a moment. Managers trump companies. Once a year, a study is published titled 100 Best Companies to Work For. The criteria for selection are such factors as, does the company have an on-site daycare facility? How much vacation does the company provide? Does the company offer any kind of profit sharing? Is the company committed to employee training? Companies are examined, and the list of the top 100 is compiled. Our research suggests that these criteria miss the mark. It's not that these employee-focused initiatives are unimportant. It's just that your immediate manager is more important. She defines and pervades your work environment. If she sets clear expectations, knows you, trusts you, and invests in you, then you can forgive the company its lack of a profit-sharing program. But if your relationship with your manager is fractured, then no amount of in-chair massaging or company-sponsored dog walking will persuade you to stay and perform. It is better to work for a great manager in an old-fashioned company than for a terrible manager in a company offering an enlightened, employee-focused culture. Sharon F., a graduate of Stanford and Harvard, left American Express a little over a year ago. She wanted to get into the publishing world, so she joined a media entertainment giant in the marketing department of one of its many magazines. She was responsible for devising loyalty programs to ensure that subscribers would renew. She loved the work, excelled at it, and caught the eye of senior management. Sharon is a very small cog in this giant machine, but according to the chairman of this giant, employees like her, bright, talented, ambitious, are the fuel for our future. Unfortunately for this giant, the fuel is leaking. After only a year, Sharon is leaving the company to join a restaurant startup as head of marketing and business development. Her boss, it appears, drove her away. He's not a bad man, she admits. He's just not a manager. He's insecure, and I don't think you can be insecure and a good manager. It makes him compete with his own people. It makes him boast about his high-style living when he should be listening to us. And he plays these silly little power games to show us who's boss. Like last week, he didn't show up for a 10 a.m. interview with a candidate who had made a 2-hour commute just to see him because he had stayed out much too late the night before. He called me at 9:55, asked me to break the news to her, and tried to make it seem like he was giving me some kind of compliment, that he could really trust me to cover for him. I can't stand behavior like that. Listening to Sharon, you might wonder if it is just a personality clash or even whether she is somehow causing the problems. So you ask her, does anyone else on the team feel the same way? I'm not sure, she confesses. I don't like to badmouth my boss, so I haven't really talked about it with anyone at work, but I do know this. When I came here, there were 13 of us on his team. Now, a year later, every single one of them has left, except me. Sharon's company does many things very well, both in terms of its overall business performance and its employee-friendly culture. But deep within this giant, unseen by senior executives or Wall Street, one individual is draining the company of power and value. As Sharon says, he is not a bad man, but he is a bad manager. Woefully miscast, he now spends his days chasing away one talented employee after another. Perhaps he is an exception. Or perhaps the giant makes a habit of promoting people into manager roles who are talented individual achievers but poor managers. The giant would certainly hope for the former, but Sharon doesn't care one way or the other. When she told her company that she was considering leaving, they offered her more money and a bigger title to try to coax her back. But they didn't offer her what she wanted most, a new manager. So she left. An employee may join Disney, GE, or Time Warner because she is lured by their generous benefits package and their reputation for valuing employees. But it is her relationship with her immediate manager that will determine how long she stays and how productive she is while she is there. Michael Eisner, Jack Welch, Gerald Levin, and all the goodwill in the world can only do so much. In the end, the Q12 items tell us that, from the employee's perspective, managers trump companies. Unlike Wall Street and the business press, employees don't put their faith in the myths of great companies or great leaders. For employees, there are only managers, great ones, poor ones, and many in between. Perhaps the best thing any leader can do to drive the whole company toward greatness is first, hold each manager accountable for how his employees respond to these 12 items, and second, help each manager know what actions to take to deserve strongly agree responses from his employees. The following chapters describe the actions the world's great managers take. But first, a case in point. What do all these discoveries mean for a specific company or a specific manager? A case in point. What do these discoveries mean for one particular company? In the winter of 1997, an extremely successful retailer asked Gallup to measure the strength of its work environment. The company employed 37,000 people spread across 300 stores, about 100 employees per store. Each one of these stores was designed and built to provide the customer with a consistent shopping experience. The building, the layout, the product positioning, the colors, every detail was honed so that the store in Atlanta would have the same distinctive brand identity as the store in Phoenix. We asked each employee to respond to the Q12 items. More than 75% of the employees chose to participate, for a total of 28,000. We then looked at the scores for each store. The following table shows an example of what we found. Two stores at opposite ends of the measuring stick. Responses were on a 1-5 scale where 1 equals strongly disagree and 5 equals strongly agree. The numbers in the table, which can be found in the bonus material, show the percentage of employees who responded 5 or strongly agree to each item. Know what is expected of me. Store A, 69%. Store B, 41%. Materials and equipment. Store A, 45%. Store B, 11%. Do what I do best every day. Store A, 55%. Store B, 19%. Recognition lasts 7 days. Store A, 42%. Store B, 20%. Supervisor, someone at work cares. Store A, 51%. Store B, 17%. Encourages development. Store A, 50%. Store B, 18%. My opinions seem to count. Store A, 36%. Store B, 9%. Mission, purpose of company. Store A, 40%. Store B, 16%. Fellow employees committed to quality. Store A, 34%. Store B, 20%. Best friend. Store A, 33%. Store B, 10%. Progress in last 6 months. Store A, 48%. Store B, 22%. Opportunities to learn and grow. Store A, 44%. Store B, 24%. These are startling differences. Whatever the company was trying to do for its employees from the center at the store level, it was communicating and implementing these initiatives in radically different ways. For the employees, Store A must have offered a much more engaging work experience than Store B. Look at the different levels of relationship, for example. In Store A, 51% of employees said they felt like someone at work cared about them. In Store B, that number sank to 17%. Given the pace of change in the business world, one of the most valuable commodities a company can possess is the employee's benefit of the doubt. If employees are willing to offer their company the benefit of the doubt, they will give every new initiative a fighting chance, no matter how sensitive or controversial it might be. Store A possesses this precious commodity. Store A's employees will tolerate ambiguity, trusting that, as events play out, their manager will be there to support them. Store B doesn't have that luxury. Lacking genuine bonds between manager and employee, Store B's employees will greet any new initiative, no matter how well-intended, with suspicion. How about individual performance? In Store A, 55% of employees said that they had a chance to do what they do best every day. In Store B, only 19% responded with a 5. What a difference that must make in terms of per-person productivity, retention, and workers' compensation claims. Wherever you look, the differences leap out at you. Do your opinions seem to count? Store A, 36%. Store B, a quarter of that, 9%. Do you have a best friend at work? Store A, 33%. Store B, only 10%. Perhaps the most bizarre discrepancy can be found in the second item. In Store A, 45% of employees strongly agreed that they had the materials and equipment they needed to do their work right. In Store B, only 11% did. The odd thing about this is that Store A and Store B had the same materials and equipment. Yet the employees' perception of them was utterly different. Everything, even the physical environment, was colored by the store manager. This company didn't have one culture. It had as many cultures as it did managers. No matter what the company's intent, each store's culture was a unique creation of the managers and supervisors in the field. Some cultures were fragile, bedeviled with mistrust and suspicion. Others were strong, able to attract and keep talented employees. For this company's leaders, the wide variation in results was actually very good news. Yes, looking only at the negative, it meant there was a limit to what the company could control from the center. The challenge of building a strong all-company culture had suddenly turned into a challenge of multiplication. On the brighter side, however, these results revealed that this company was blessed with some truly exemplary managers. These managers had built productive businesses by engaging the talents and passions of their people. In its quest to attract productive employees, this company could now stop hunting for the magical central fix. Instead, it could find out what its newly highlighted cadre of brilliant managers was doing, and then build its company culture around this blueprint. It could try to hire more like its best. It could take the ideas of its best and multiply them company-wide. It could redesign training programs based on the practices of its best. To build a stronger culture, this company wouldn't have to borrow ideas from the likes of best practice companies like Disney, Southwest Airlines, or the Ritz-Carlton, all it would have to do is learn from its own best. So what if this company does learn from its best, some might ask? Do more fives on the Q12 items necessarily translate to higher levels of real performance? Does store A actually outperform store B on any of the more traditional performance measures, like sales, profit, or retention? Of course, our general discoveries would say yes. Workplaces where many employees can answer positively to the Q12 items will indeed be more productive. But this is too general. We wanted to know the specifics. So we asked the company to supply us with the raw performance data that it would normally use to measure a store's productivity. We punched in these scores and then compared them with each store's scores on the Q12 items. This is what we found. Stores scoring in the top 25% on the employee opinion survey were, on average, 4.56% over their sales budget for the year, while those scoring in the bottom 25% were 0.84% below budget. In real numbers, this is a difference of $104 million of sales per year between the two groups. If realized, this figure would represent a 2.6% increase in the company's total sales. Profit-loss comparisons told an even more dramatic story. The top 25% of stores on the survey ended the year almost 14% over their profit budget. Stores in the bottom group missed their profit goals by a full 30%. Employee turnover levels were also vastly different. Each store in the top group retained, on average, 12 more employees per year than each store in the bottom group. Across both groups, this means that the top 25% scoring stores on the survey retained 1,000 more employees per year than did the bottom group of stores. If you estimate that the wage of the average store employee is $18,000, and that the cost of finding, hiring, and training each new employee is 1.5 times his salary, then the total cost of the company for the different levels of retention between the two groups is $18,000 times 1.5 times 1,000 equals $27 million. And that's just the hard cost. The drain of experienced employees who have developed valuable relationships with their customers and their colleagues is harder to measure, but is just as significant a loss. These results are compelling. In this company, business units with employees who answered positively to the Q12 items were measurably more productive. Excellent frontline managers had engaged their employees, and these engaged employees had provided the foundation for top performance. Any measuring stick worth its salt not only tells you where you stand, it also helps you decide what to do next. So what can a manager, any manager, do to secure fives on the Q12 items and so engage his employees? First, you have to know where to start. Gallup's research revealed that some items were more foundational than others. This implies that you, the manager, should address these 12 items in the right order. There's little point attacking the lesser items if you have ignored the most foundational. In fact, as many managers discover to their detriment, addressing the 12 items in the wrong order is both very tempting and actively dangerous. We will show you why. And by way of contrast, we will describe where the world's great managers start laying the foundations for a truly productive workplace. Mountain climbing. Why is there an order to the 12 items? To help us describe the order of the Q12 items, we ask you to picture, in your mind's eye, a mountain. At first, it is hard to make out its full shape and color, shifting from blue to gray to green as you approach. But now, standing at the base, you sense its presence. You know there is a climb ahead. You know the climb will vary, sometimes steep, sometimes gradual. You know there will be gullies to negotiate and terrain that will force you to descend before you can resume your climb. You know the dangers, too, the cold, the clouds, and the most pressing danger of all, your own fragile will. But then you think of the summit and how you will feel, so you start to climb. You know this mountain. We all do. It is the psychological climb you make from the moment you take on a new role to the moment you feel fully engaged in that role. At the base of the mountain, perhaps you are joining a new company. Perhaps you have just been promoted to a new role within the same company. Either way, you are at the start of a long climb. At the summit of this mountain, you are still in the same role. The mountain doesn't represent a career climb, but you are loyal and productive in this role. You are the machinist who bothers to write down all the little hints and tips you have picked up so that you can present them as an informal manual to apprentice machinists just learning their craft. You are the grocery store clerk who tells the customer that the grapefruit are in aisle 5, but who then walks her to aisle 5, explaining that the grapefruit are always stocked from the back to the front. If you like your grapefruit really firm, you say, pick one from the front. You are the manager who so loves your work that you get tears in your eyes when asked to describe how you helped so many of your people succeed. Whatever your role, at the summit of this mountain, you are good at what you do. You know the fundamental purpose of your work, and you are always looking for better ways to fulfill that mission. You are fully engaged. How did you get there? If a manager can answer this, he will know how to guide other employees. He will be able to help more and more individuals reach the summit. The more individuals he can help move up the mountain one by one, the stronger the workplace. So how did you get there? How did you make the climb? Put on your employee hat for a moment. This may be a psychological mountain, but as with an actual mountain, you have to climb it in stages. Read in the right order, the 12 items can tell you which stage is which, and exactly what needs must be met before you can continue your climb up to the next stage. Before we describe the stages in the climb, think back to the needs you had when you were first starting your current role. What did you want from the role? What needs were foremost in your mind at that time? Then, as time passed and you settled in, how did your needs change? And what are your current priorities? What do you need from your role today? You may want to keep these thoughts in mind as we describe the stages on the climb. Base camp. What do I get? When you first start a new role, your needs are pretty basic. You want to know what is going to be expected of you. How much are you going to earn? How long will your commute be? Will you have an office, a desk, even a phone? At this stage, you are asking, what do I get from this role? Of the 12, these two fundamental items measure base camp. Q1, I know what is expected of me at work. Q2, I have the materials and equipment I need to do my work right. Camp 1, what do I give? You climb a little higher. Your perspective changes. You start asking different questions. You want to know whether you are any good at the job. Are you in a role where you can excel? Do other people think you are excelling? If not, what do they think about you? Will they help you? At this stage, your questions center around, what do I give? You are focused on your individual contribution and other people's perceptions of it. These four items measure Camp 1. Q3. At work, I have the opportunity to do what I do best every day. Q4. In the last 7 days, I have received recognition or praise for doing good work. Q5. My supervisor or someone at work seems to care about me as a person. Few 6. There is someone at work who encourages my development. Each of these items helps you know not only if you feel you are doing well in the role, Q3, but also if other people value your individual performance, Q4. If they value you as a person, Q5. And if they are prepared to invest in your growth, Q6. These items all address the issue of your individual self-esteem and worth. As we will see, if these questions remain unanswered, all of your yearnings to belong, to become part of a team, to learn and to innovate, will be undermined. Camp 2. Do I belong here? You keep climbing. By now you have asked some difficult questions of yourself and of others, and the questions have hopefully given you strength. Your perspective widens. You look around and ask, do I belong here? You may be extremely customer service oriented. Is everyone else as customer driven as you? Or perhaps you define yourself by your creativity. Are you surrounded by people who push the envelope as you do? Whatever your basic value system happens to be, at this stage of the climb, you really want to know if you fit. These 4 items measure Camp 2. Q7. At work, my opinions seem to count. Q8. The mission or purpose of my company makes me feel my job is important. Q9. My associates or fellow employees are committed to doing quality work. Q10. I have a best friend at work. Camp 3. How can we all grow? This is the most advanced stage of the climb. At this stage, you are impatient for everyone to improve, asking, how can we all grow? You want to make things better, to learn, to grow, and to innovate. This stage tells us that only after you have climbed up and through the earlier 3 stages can you innovate effectively. Why? Because there is a difference between invention and innovation. Invention is mere novelty. Like most of us, you might have devised 17 new ways of doing things a few weeks after starting in your new role. But these ideas didn't carry any weight. By contrast, innovation is novelty that can be applied. And you can innovate, you can apply your new ideas, only if you are focused on the right expectations, base camp. If you have confidence in your own expertise, camp 1. And if you are aware of how the people around you will accept or reject your new ideas, camp 2. If you cannot answer positively to all these earlier items, then you will find it almost impossible to apply all your new ideas. These 2 items measure Camp 3. Q11. In the last 6 months, someone at work has talked to me about my progress. Q12. This last year, I have had opportunities at work to learn and grow. The summit. If you can respond positively to all of the Q12 items, then you have reached the summit. Your focus is clear. You feel a recurring sense of achievement, as though the best of you is being called upon, and the best of you responds every single day. You look around and see others who also seem to thrill to the challenge of their work. Buoyed by your mutual understanding and your shared purpose, you climbers look out and forward to the challenges marching over the horizon. It is not easy to remain at the summit for long, with the ground shifting beneath your feet and the strong winds buffeting you this way and that. But while you are there, it is quite a feeling. If this is the psychological climb you made, or failed to make, from the moment you began your current role to the moment you felt fully engaged in this role, then where are you? Camp 1? Camp 3? The summit? Ask yourself to respond to those 12 items. Your answers can give you a read on where you are on the mountain. Perhaps your company is going through times of change, and you find yourself languishing down at base camp. Change can do that to a person. You genuinely want to commit, but the uncertainty keeps pushing you down. Quit telling me how great the future's going to be. Just tell me what is expected of me today. Perhaps you have just been promoted. You felt as though you were at the summit in your previous role, but now you find yourself right back down at Camp 1 with new expectations and a new manager. I wonder what he thinks of me. I wonder how he will define success. Yes, even when good things happen, you can quickly find yourself at the base of a new mountain with a long climb ahead. Of course, the climb toward the summit is more complicated than this picture. Not only will people trade one stage off against another, but each individual will also place a slightly different value on each stage of the climb. For example, you might have taken your current role simply because it offered you the chance to learn and grow. In a sense, you flew straight into Camp 3. And if these higher-level needs are being met, then you will probably be a little more patient in waiting for your manager to make his expectations crystal clear, down to base camp. Similarly, if you feel very connected to your team members, up to Camp 2, then you may be prepared to stick it out for a while longer, even though you feel that your role on the team doesn't allow you to use your true talents, down to Camp 1. However, these kinds of individual trade-offs don't deny the basic truth of the mountain. Regardless of how positively you respond to the items at Camp 2 or Camp 3, the longer your lower-level needs remain unmet, the more likely it is that you will burn out, become unproductive, and leave. In fact, if you do find yourself answering positively to Camps 2 and 3, but negatively to the items lower down, be very careful. You are in an extremely precarious position. On the surface, everything seems fine. You like your team members, up to Camp 2, and you are learning and growing, up to Camp 3. But deep down, you are disengaged. Not only are you less productive than you could be, but you would jump ship at the first good offer. We can give this condition a name: mountain sickness. In the physical world, mountain sickness is brought on by the lack of oxygen at high altitudes. Starved of oxygen, your heart starts pounding. You feel breathless and disoriented. If you don't climb down to lower altitudes, your lungs will fill with fluid and you will die. There is no way to cheat mountain sickness. There's no vaccine, no antidote. The only way to beat it is to climb down and give your body time to acclimatize. Inexperienced climbers might suggest that if you have lots of money and not much time, you could helicopter into Camp 3 and race to the summit. Experienced guides know that you would never make it. Mountain sickness would sap your energy and slow your progress to a crawl. These guides will tell you that to reach the summit, you have to pay your dues. During your ascent, you have to spend a great deal of time between base camp and Camp 1. The more time you spend at these lower reaches, the more stamina you will have in the thin air near the summit. In the psychological world, their advice still applies. Base camp and Camp 1 are the foundation. If you spend time focusing on these needs and find a manager who can meet these needs, you will have the strength necessary for the long climb ahead. Ignore these needs, and you are much more likely to psychologically disengage. An epidemic of mountain sickness. Now, put your manager hat back on. This metaphorical mountain reveals that the key to building a strong, vibrant workplace lies in meeting employees' needs at base camp and Camp 1. This is where you should focus your time and energy. If your employees' lower-level needs remain unaddressed, then everything you do for them further along the journey is almost irrelevant. But if you can meet these needs successfully, then the rest, the team building and the innovating, is so much easier. It almost sounds obvious, but over the last 15 years, most managers have been encouraged to focus much higher up the mountain. mission statements, diversity training, and self-directed work teams all try to help employees feel like they belong. Camp 2. Total quality management, re-engineering, continuous improvement, and learning organizations all address the need for employees to innovate, to challenge cozy assumptions and rebuild them afresh every day. Camp 3. All of these initiatives were well conceived. Many of them were well executed. But almost all of them have withered. 5 years ago, the Baldrige Award for Quality was the most coveted business award in America. Today, only a few companies bother to enter. Diversity experts now bicker over the proper definition of diversity. Process re-engineering gurus try to squeeze people back into process. And many of us snort at mission statements. When you think about it, it is rather sad. An important kernel of truth lay at the heart of all of these initiatives, but none of them lasted. Why? An epidemic of mountain sickness. They aimed too high, too fast. Managers were encouraged to focus on complex initiatives like re-engineering or learning organizations without spending time on the basics. The stages on the mountain reveal that if the employee doesn't know what is expected of him as an individual, base camp, then you shouldn't ask him to get excited about playing on a team, camp 2. If he feels as though he is in the wrong role, camp 1, don't pander to him by telling him how important his innovative ideas are to the company's re-engineering efforts, camp 3. If he doesn't know what his manager thinks of him as an individual, Camp 1, don't confuse him by challenging him to become part of the new learning organization, Camp 3. Don't helicopter in at 17,000 feet, because sooner or later, you and your people will die on the mountain. The focus of great managers. Great managers take aim at base camp and camp 1. They know that the core of a strong and vibrant workplace can be found in the first 6 items. Q1, I know what is expected of me at work. Q2, I have the materials and equipment I need to do my work right. Q3, at work, I have the opportunity to do what I do best every day. Q4, in the last 7 days, I have received recognition or praise for doing good work. Q5, my supervisor or someone at work seems to care about me as a person. Q6, there is someone at work who encourages my development. Securing 5s to these items is one of your most important responsibilities. And as many managers discover, getting all 5s from your employees is far from easy. For example, the manager who tries to curry favor with his people by telling them that they should all be promoted may receive 5s on the item, there is someone at work who encourages my development. However, because all his employees now feel they are in the wrong role, he will get 1s on the item, at work I have the opportunity to do what I do best every day. Similarly, the manager who tries to control his employees' behavior by writing a thick policies and procedures manual will receive 5s on the item, I know what is expected of me at work. But because of his rigid policing management style, he will probably receive 1s on the item, my supervisor or someone at work seems to care about me as a person. To secure 5s on all of these items, you have to reconcile responsibilities that, at first sight, appear contradictory. You have to be able to set consistent expectations for all your people, yet at the same time treat each person differently. You have to be able to make each person feel as though he is in a role that uses his talents, while simultaneously challenging him to grow. You have to care about each person, praise each person, and if necessary, terminate a person you have cared about and praised. F. Scott Fitzgerald believed that the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in mind at the same time and still maintain the ability to function. In this sense, great managers possess a unique intelligence. In the following chapters, we will describe this intelligence. We will help you look through the eyes of the world's great managers and see how they balance their conflicting responsibilities. We will show you how they find, focus, and develop so many talented employees so effectively. Chapter 2: The Wisdom of Great Managers. Words from the Wise. What Great Managers Know. What Great Managers Do. The Four Keys. Words from the Wise. Whom did Gallup interview? How do the best managers in the world lay the foundations of a strong workplace? The flood of answers is rising and threatens to swamp even the most level-headed managers. In 1975, 200 books were published on the subject of managing and leading. By 1997, that number had more than tripled. In fact, over the last 20 years, authors have offered up over 9,000 different systems, languages, principles, and paradigms to help explain the mysteries of management and leadership. This barrage of conflicting, impressionistic, and largely anecdotal advice is overwhelming, but it rarely enlightens. It lacks precision and simplicity. Something is missing, even from the most persuasive advice. There are volumes of case studies and here's how I did it personal success stories, but very little quantitative research and virtually no standard of measurement. No one has ever interviewed the best managers in the world and then systematically compared their answers with the answers of average managers. No one has ever allowed great managers to define themselves. No one has tapped the source. So Gallup did. This second research effort was the inevitable companion to the first. In the previous chapter, we described the link between engaged employees and business unit outcomes and revealed the critical role managers everywhere play. In this chapter, we seek to delve into the minds of the world's great managers and find out how they engaged so successfully the hearts, minds, and talents of their people. Year after year, we asked our clients to give us their great managers to interview. It was not always easy to identify who the best ones were, so we began by asking, "Which of your managers would you dearly love to clone?" In some organizations, this was the only criterion available. However, in the great majority of organizations, there were performance scores, scores measuring productivity and profit, scores for shrinkage, for absenteeism, for employee accidents, and most important perhaps, scores reflecting the feedback of customers and of the employees themselves. We used these performance scores to sort out the great managers from the rest. We interviewed more than 80,000 managers. We interviewed hotel supervisors, sales managers, general agents, senior account executives, manufacturing team leaders, professional sports coaches, pub managers, public school superintendents, captains, majors, and colonels in the military, and even a selection of deacons, priests, and pastors. We interviewed each great manager for about an hour and a half using open-ended questions. For example, as a manager, which would you rather have? An independent, aggressive person who produced $1.2 million in sales, or a congenial team player who produced about half as much? Please explain your choice. You have an extremely productive employee who consistently fouls up the paperwork. How would you work with this person to help him or her be more productive? You have two managers. One has the best talent for management you have ever seen. The other is mediocre. There are two openings available. The first is a high-performing territory. The second is a territory that is struggling. Neither territory has yet reached its potential. Where would you recommend the excellent manager be placed? Why? You can find out what great managers said to these questions in Appendix B. We tape recorded, transcribed, read, and reread the answers to these and hundreds of similar questions. Using the same questions, we then interviewed great managers' less successful colleagues. These managers were neither failing nor excelling. They were average managers. We tape recorded, transcribed, read, and reread their answers. Then we compared. We listened to 120,000 hours of tape. We combed through 5 million pages of transcripts. We searched for patterns. What, if anything, did the best have in common? And what, if anything, distinguished them from their less successful colleagues? It turns out that great managers share less than you might think. If you were to line them all up against a wall, you would see different sexes, races, ages, and physiques. If you were to work for them, you would feel different styles of motivation, of direction, and of relationship building. The truth is, they don't have much in common at all. However, deep within these variations, there was one insight, one shared wisdom, to which all of these great managers kept returning. What great managers know. What is the revolutionary insight shared by all great managers? An old parable will serve to introduce the insight they shared. There once lived a scorpion and a frog. The scorpion wanted to cross the pond, but being a scorpion, he couldn't swim. So he scuttled up to the frog and asked, "Please, Mr. Frog, can you carry me across the pond on your back?" "I would," replied the frog, "but under the circumstances I must refuse. You might sting me as I swim across." "But why would I do that?" asked the scorpion. "It is not in my interests to sting you, because you will die, and then I will drown." Although the frog knew how lethal scorpions were, the logic proved quite persuasive. Perhaps, felt the frog, in this one instance, the scorpion would keep his tail in check. So the frog agreed. The scorpion climbed onto his back, and together they set off across the pond. Just as they reached the middle of the pond, the scorpion twitched his tail and stung the frog. Mortally wounded, the frog cried out, "Why did you sting me? It is not in your interests to sting me, because now I will die and you will drown." "I know," replied the scorpion as he sank into the pond, "but I am a scorpion. I have to sting you. It's in my nature." Conventional wisdom encourages you to think like the frog. "People's natures do change," it whispers. "Anyone can be anything they want to be if they just try hard enough." Indeed, as a manager, it is your duty to direct those changes. Devise rules and policies to control your employees' unruly inclinations. Teach them skills and competencies to fill in the traits they lack. All of your best efforts as a manager should focus on either muzzling or correcting what nature saw fit to provide. Great managers reject this out of hand. They remember what the frog forgot. Each individual, like the scorpion, is true to his unique nature. They recognize that each person is motivated differently, and that each person has his own way of thinking and his own style of relating to others. They know that there is a limit to how much remolding they can do to someone. But they don't bemoan these differences and try to grind them down. Instead, they capitalize on them. They try to help each person become more and more of who he already is. Simply put, this is the one insight we heard echoed by tens of thousands of great managers. People don't change that much. Don't waste time trying to put in what was left out. try to draw out what was left in. That is hard enough. This insight is the source of their wisdom. It explains everything they do with and for their people. It is the foundation of their success as managers. This insight is revolutionary. It explains why great managers do not believe that everyone has unlimited potential, why they do not help people fix their weaknesses, why they insist on breaking the golden rule with every single employee, and why they play favorites. It explains why great managers break all the rules of conventional wisdom. Simple though it may sound, this is a complex and subtle insight. If you applied it without sophistication, you could quickly find yourself suggesting that managers should ignore people's weaknesses, and that all training is a complete waste of time. Neither is true. Like all revolutionary messages, this particular insight requires explanation. How do great managers apply it? What does it ask of employees? What does it mean for companies? Over the next chapters, we will answer these questions. But before we do, we have to agree on what a manager, any manager, actually does. What is their unique function in a company? What role do they play? What great managers do. What are the four basic roles of a great manager? Tony F., a senior executive in a large entertainment conglomerate, has a familiar complaint. Smart individual performers keep getting moved into manager positions without the slightest idea of what the manager role is, let alone the ability to play it. We send them off to one of those leadership development courses, but they come back more impressed with their mini-executive status than with the day-to-day challenges of being a good manager. No one knows what being a good manager is anymore. Maybe Tony is right. No one knows what being a good manager is anymore. And on top of that, nobody cares. Conventional wisdom tells us that the manager role is no longer very important. Apparently, managers are now an impediment to speed, flexibility, and agility. Today's agile companies can no longer afford to employ armies of managers to shuffle papers, sign approvals, and monitor performance. They need self-reliant, self-motivated, self-directed work teams. No wonder managers were first against the wall when the re-engineering revolution came. Besides, continues conventional wisdom, every manager should be a leader. He must seize opportunity, using his smarts and impatience to exert his will over a fickle world. In this world, the staid little manager is a misfit. It is too quick for him, too exciting, too dangerous. He'd better stay out of the way, he might get hurt. Conventional wisdom has led us all astray. Yes, today's business pressures are more intense, the changes neck snappingly fast. Yes, companies need self-reliant employees and aggressive leaders, but all this does not diminish the importance of managers. On the contrary, in turbulent times, the manager is more important than ever. Why? Because managers play a vital and distinct role, a role that charismatic leaders and self-directed teams are incapable of playing. The manager role is to reach inside each employee and release his unique talents into performance. This role is best played one employee at a time, one manager asking questions of, listening to, and working with one employee. Multiplied 1,000-fold, this one by one by one role is the company's power supply. In times of great change, it is this role that makes the company robust. Robust enough to stay focused when needed, yet robust enough to flex without breaking. In this sense, the manager role is the catalyst role. As with all catalysts, the manager's function is to speed up the reaction between two substances, thus creating the desired end product. Specifically, the manager creates performance in each employee by speeding up the reaction between the employee's talents and the company's goals, and between the employee's talents and the customer's needs. When hundreds of managers play this role well, the company becomes strong, one employee at a time. No doubt, in today's slimmed-down business world, most of these managers also shoulder other responsibilities. They are expected to be subject matter experts, individual superstars, and sometimes leaders in their own right. These are important roles which great managers execute with varying styles and degrees of success. But when it comes to the manager aspect of their responsibilities, great managers all excel at this catalyst role. Think back to the six items measuring base camp and camp one. Q1, I know what is expected of me at work. Q2, I have the materials and equipment I need to do my work right. Q3, at work, I have the opportunity to do what I do best every day. Q4, in the last 7 days, I have received recognition or praise for doing good work. Q5, my supervisor or someone at work seems to care about me as a person. Q6, there is someone at work who encourages my development. These items provide the detail for the catalyst role. To warrant positive responses to these items from his employees, a manager must be able to do four activities extremely well. Select a person, set expectations, motivate the person, and develop the person. These four activities are the manager's most important responsibilities. You might have all the vision, charisma, and intelligence in the world, but if you cannot perform these four activities well, you will never excel as a manager. 1. To secure strongly agree responses to the item, at work I have the opportunity to do what I do best every day, you must know how to select a person. This sounds straightforward, but to do it well demands clear-headedness. Most important, you must know how much of a person you can change. You must know the difference between talent, skills, and knowledge. You must know which of these can be taught and which can only be hired in. You must know how to ask the kinds of questions that can cut through a candidate's desire to impress and so reveal his true talents. If you don't know how to do these things, you will always struggle as a manager. Cursed with poorly cast employees, all your efforts to motivate and develop will be diminished. 2. If you want strongly agree responses to the items, I know what is expected of me at work, and I have the materials and equipment I need to do my work right, you must be able to set accurate performance expectations. This activity encompasses more than simple goal setting. You must be able to keep employees focused on performance today, no matter how tempting it is to stare at the changes massing over the horizon. You must know on which parts of a job you will enforce conformity and on which parts you will encourage your employees to exercise their own style. You must be able to balance today's need for standardization and efficiency with a similarly pressing need for flair and originality. If you don't know how to set these kinds of performance expectations, you will always be off balance, lurching haphazardly between enforcing too many rules and enduring too much chaos. 3. Strongly agree responses to the items, in the last 7 days I have received recognition or praise for doing good work, and my supervisor or someone at work seems to care about me as a person, are driven by your ability to motivate each employee. As a manager, you have only one thing to invest, your time. Whom you spend it with and how you spend it determine your success as a manager. So, should you spend more time with your best people or your strugglers? Should you help a person fix his weaknesses or should you focus on his strengths? Can you ever give someone too much praise? If so, when? If not, why not? You must be able to answer these questions if you are to excel at helping each employee excel. 4. The item, "My supervisor or someone at work seems to care about me as a person," is also driven